You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and often separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we would like to welcome you. David and I are old friends. We've been talking movies for so many years, we don't want to let you in on that little secret. But we like to share what we know, our knowledge, because we've talked about some of these films multiple times. Mm-hmm. Not today's, but we have done that with several others. If you're coming back, you know this, and we'd like to thank you for coming back. We hope you enjoy our little program here. I am here with my good friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. It's a good day. It's bright and shiny out as opposed to what we're going to be talking about. So that's a good thing.
I toned my intro down a little bit, if you noticed.
Yes.
Because of the topic and subject matter.
Yes. Makes sense. And normally we start our podcast each episode with what we've been doing in our genre week. I'm happy to announce that I did do something genre related this past week. I got to watch a film that's been on my list for a while. As a matter of fact, I think I did a Coming to Get You about it when it first trailed, or the first trailer was released last year. But it's
trailed.
When it first trailed out of Cinema World, called Creator, or The Creator, actually.
I remember you talking about it.
Not to be confused with Creator, which is a Peter O'Toole movie, which is awesome. This is The Creator, came out in 2023, had pretty much a little bit of hype about it just because the director is Gareth Edwards, and he was the same guy who did Rogue One. And very popular and everything else. So I was excited about it. Just a brief synopsis from the IMDb storyline. Amid a future war between the human race and the forces of artificial intelligence, the buzz topic of all plot lines for the next few years probably, Joshua, a hardened ex-special forces agent grieving the disappearance of his wife, is recruited to hunt down and kill the Creator, the elusive architect of advanced AI who has developed a mysterious weapon with the power to end the war and mankind itself.
Is this a movie or a series?
Is this a movie? It is.
Isn't it something like tied in? When you talked about it, it seems like it was like really hyped, like Star Wars or something.
No, that's the Zach. The I don't like it.
Oh,
movie.
No. I'm not talking about the Zack Snyder crap.
Right.
I'm talking about, you said this was really good or looked really good.
The trailer
good.
Looked great, and everybody was hyping it, especially the Star Wars contingent, because this is the guy who done Rogue One, one of the best Star Wars movies.
That's the connection I'm looking for. Okay.
So everybody was hyped over it and excited and everything else. This movie is not very good. As a matter of fact, I would I would probably use this to teach how not to do a movie, because it looks phenomenal. The lensing is great, the lighting, the production design, the CGI is flawless. I mean, there's a lot of androids in this, I guess you would call them, because they are human-looking robots, but they have no rear part of their head. Their whole head has a big hole in it, and it moves and articulates. Remember how they did the body parts of Ex Machina with her? It's done like that. So they'll have artificial limbs that have holes right here, and you just see all the mechanization and everything. And then their hand looks totally realistic. So it's that kind of great CGI, amazing action sequences. But it's basically a very long, protracted Mandalorian episode, unfortunately. And I'm not sure how much the studio influenced him. It's written by him, too. It's written by him and Chris Weitz or Weitz. And so I'm not certain how much the studio might have said, yeah, give it more Mandalorian. Hey, make this, make him, because basically he is.
Bring a baby in.
Well, the you know, the secret weapon that the creator has created is a child.
Is Baby Yoda.
Well, essentially, yeah, it's a little boy who has magical powers.
Oh my God.
And so he has to protect this little boy and get him across this barren landscape.
Oh my God, it is the Mandalorian.
It is.
That's crazy.
It is. And sadly, it has not a good climax. It has not a good. Some of it has to do with John Edward Washington. He's the lead in it. I think he's adequate, but I got no real emotional empathy with him. The child that plays Alfie is strong. I mean, it's got a good cast. Gemma Chan is in it. So it's got some great elements, but just plotting and story, I went, okay. And things that just didn't make sense. I'm not going to go into it, but it's what I did in my genre week, and I wouldn't recommend it to anybody else unless you just want to see some great CGI, you know.
Okay.
So.
Well, I would definitely recommend My Genre Week, and I have been waiting for this one I would say about 8 or 9 months since I did a Coming to Get You on it.
Okay.
And it is a little film called Suitable Flesh.
Oh, you finally watched it. Okay.
Yeah, it finally landed. I mean, they kept saying it was coming to Shudder, but it never did, and now it has landed.
Okay.
This movie... you will love it, I think. I mean, well, let me just explain. It's a loving homage to the 1980s Lovecraft films of Stuart Gordon.
Okay.
Namely, Reanimator and From Beyond. It stars Barbara Crampton, who was in those Gordon films.
Okay.
Yeah. It was written by Dennis Pauley, who wrote those films, and it was produced by Brian Yuzna, who also produced those Gordon films.
Yeah. So
the only person that's not back is Stuart Gordon, and that's because he's no longer with us.
Right.
It is an adaptation of a 1933 Lovecraft story called The Thing on the Doorstep.
Okay.
This movie is directed by Joe Lynch, who I had never heard of, but I like the movie a lot. There's only a few detractors, but they don't detract enough to dissuade me from not recommending it. And there's some optical effects that they rely heavily on and sometimes too long, and it bothers me.
Okay.
Other than that, it's great. The cast is amazing. It stars Heather Graham, who is, I swear she doesn't age. I think she just stays perpetually young. Judah Lewis is in it. I had not heard of him. And then I was flipping through something the other day and saw him in the cast. I was like, oh, that's that guy from Suitable Flesh.
Okay.
Bruce Davidson, who you would remember, he was like an 80s actor.
Yep.
And then Barbara Crampton is also in it.
Isn't she like 80?
She is 60, and Heather Graham is like 55 or so, and they look great in it. I mean, you wouldn't know at all that they're as old as they are. They look wonderful.
Okay.
The synopsis is psychiatrist Elizabeth Derby becomes obsessed with helping a young patient who is suffering from extreme personality disorder. However, it soon leads her into occult danger as she tries to escape from a horrific fate.
Okay.
The reason I say this is a lot like, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why this is like a Stuart Gordon film from the 80s, but the main one is that they don't shy away from sex and nudity at all in this. I mean, sex is a primary motivation, really, in this movie.
Well, goodness, let me add this to my list.
It only gets 84% on Rotten Tomatoes with 70 reviews, but I'm on board with it.
Okay.
because other than those repetitive obstacles I talked about, this movie rocks. I seriously considered swapping it for one of ours on next season.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I'll wait because I'm just now getting to some that came out a few years ago. So I'm just going to wait.
Okay. Anyway,
that's what I did in my genre week.
Wow. Well, Flesh is part of an undercurrent of the particular one we're going to talk about today.
Flesh, yes.
So
that's sustenance.
Yeah. Flesh is people. You know, Soylent Green is people. So we are going to delve into how's the best way to describe this? It's post-apocalyptic. It's science fiction. It came out in 2009. It has some great.
It looks like a zombie film, but it's not. It yep. doesn't have any zombies in it.
Has some great reviews. It's a movie called The Road. It's directed by John Hillcoat. We'll talk about him with production here. It is written by Joe Penhelm, based on the novel by Cormac McCarthy, who I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit too. Stars Viggo Mortensen, Charlize Theron, Cody Smith McPhee. A brief synopsis. I'm not going to do the one on IMDb because I think it delves in it too much. But in a dangerous post-apocalyptic world, an ailing father defends his son as they slowly travel to the sea is the one word
basically it.
Kind of thing. And that's mm-hmm. basically it. Well, let's start out simple. Had you seen this movie before?
I have. I saw it when it came out on DVD back in 2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you think about it?
Well, I was a fan of the book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm a huge, huge fan of this book. This book blew me away back then. I reread it before I watched it this time, and it still blows me away. And this movie does a really good job of capturing the essence. I love this movie. I think this movie, people are going to think I am a warped individual because I guess my horror movie background, but I would almost put this in my top 10 movies of all time.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, definitely in my top 20, probably. And I didn't realize it till I rewatched it. And I was like, I forgot how good this is.
Wow. Okay. So, yeah. So my experience is I've never read the book. I've never read anything by Cormac, although he's supposedly the modern Hemingway. You know,
he's from Knoxville.
Yeah. And I had never seen this movie. So this was.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I put it on our list because I had not seen it, so I wanted to. And go into it blind, but doing preliminary research on it, a lot of the just without looking at any of them, a lot of the headlines was, is this the most depressing book ever written? Is this the most depressing movie? Oh my God, I can't finish this movie. It's too much. That kind of headlines. And I was like, okay, interesting. I didn't leave it that way. It is an extremely dark, depressing kind of film.
I don't think it's depressing. It's just bleak.
Well, bleak. Okay, say bleak. But I don't think the ending is bleak. I think
no, it's got a happy ending.
I think the ending is actually telegraphed fairly quickly from about the midpoint of the story all the way through. Mm. And it actually is a twist at the very, very end that actually works for me and is like you said, uplifting and works. It's not a heavily plotted movie. It's basically just a series of vignettes, a series of situations that are tied together with some flashbacks, but it's
and a road.
And the road is the right. overall undercurrent of it. But people saying that, oh, it's post-apocalyptic, oh, it's terribly depressing. Oh, this is a story about love and about a father and his son and what you would do for that. And it's so well told. And
that was what I was going to say. I don't know that I can think of another film out there that captures a father's love for his kid like this does.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it is so ingrained in this film. It's just, it squeezes it. It squeezes my heart, I guess is the best way to put it.
And the sacrifices you would make and you have to make mm-hmm. and everything else. And also the whole change of a child's image of his father and how mm-hmm. that can augment and change, you know, and him saying, are we the good people? kind of thing. But
Walking Dead.
Well, that's, you know, number one key to this is freaking Walking Dead. I mean, Jesus
pretty much,
Christ.
Yeah.
It is. But I just found the performances so strong, and I thought the storytelling, although, like I said, it's not a heavily plotted movie. It's just, here's the situation, how do you react to it? And we're watching our characters react, and there's only like six characters in the whole freaking movie, you know? It's very
yeah, other than some ragtag scavengers and stuff. And I love how the main ragtag scavengers are played by very famous people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
all the extras are small parts are played by pretty big people, pretty big faces.
Well, and normally we start with scenes and stuff. I mean, what are your mm-hmm. key scenes for this?
Oh, man. Well, the first one would, you know, I'm going to go to the horrific ones. The first one, and I remembered it in the book. And then as soon as it happened in the movie, I was like, oh, fuck, that's the house. That's the house with the basement. No, no. And it's when they go down in the basement and all those people are being held captive in like a living meat locker. That yeah. scene will forever haunt me.
Yeah. I call it.
I got some very
in my list. I called it Cannibal Basement.
Yeah, it's horrible, and then some of them are just missing pieces. Like they,
oh yeah,
just keeping them alive, and they're so fucking skinny. I don't know how they cast that, or if it was CGI or whatever. That scene, but I mean, I don't want to just do bleak scenes. The end mm-hmm. is great. I don't know if you watched the outtakes or the deleted scenes, but they cut a lot of his goodbye to his father at the end. And I hate that they did that because it's so big in the book, his conversation with his father when he's saying goodbye.
Okay. I did not see
and
any
then,
of those.
The flashbacks with Charlize are great mm-hmm. too.
The flashbacks are great in their sparseness. And the way there really is, even from the very beginning, that whole opening is great. And his first flashback of how the fires waking him up at night. And we get no closure on that scene. We get her going, why are you taking a bath? Because it's not for a bath. And he's running the water. And she looks out and you don't see what she sees. And we cut. And we're back to present. And the same right. thing with her leaving, saying, no, you don't understand. They're going to rape me. They're going to rape him, and then they're going to eat us. And mm-hmm. da da da. And she, and then him pleading with her to please try everything else, and she goes, she can't, and she leaves. And we don't know where she goes, but we know she is out of the picture, and it's probably suicide or something or whatever. It's heavily implied. And I found that was a really great kind of mashup or alternative to the very, very end where there is a family that really did survive. And it's mm-hmm. the mother, the father, the son, and a dog even. And they all
– a dog, I know.
And they yeah. all lived through it. They fought hard enough for each other and together to do mm-hmm. it. And Charlize just couldn't. Her character couldn't, which is very realistic and very practical, I guess, or factual.
Yeah, what was that movie we did recently, the – on the beach,
yeah.
where they had like government issued suicide pills.
Yeah.
It's too bad she didn't have one of those because I'm sure she had to do something else.
Well, but she would have been in line for that, you know.
Right. She would have.
Mm-hmm. The other scenes that stand out with me are any scene all the way through this where he narrates. That verbiage, which I'm sure is probably from the book, is just amazing. The way he writes stuff about the man and the boy and the way he says that, it's just so good. Bleak, yes, very bleak and very antithesis of society and what, you know, society has done to us kind of thing. But it's so good and yeah. moody and great.
I have the book on audio, and the guy that reads it's really good. I can't remember his name.
Okay.
But Cormac, one of the reasons I love him, and I don't want to sound like I'm indulging myself, but I just realized while reading this that I write very similarly. He is heavy on dialogue and very little on exposition. I do that in my romance novels. I tend to carry the story with conversation.
Okay.
I did not do that. For folks out there that don't, obviously don't read my romance, if you read my horror novel, that's different because that is a one person. So any conversation is pretty much internal monologue mm-hmm. and a lot of exposition. But I've been writing much more romance than I have horror. And in my romances, I propel everything with conversation. And that's how this book is. And it's very snippet conversation, like one word sentences and two and three. This movie captures the essence of that. And I read somewhere where the screenwriter only agreed to do it if he could use the exact dialogue that McCarthy used in the novel.
Which makes sense. And I think a lot of the voiceover is internal monologue. That's almost all from the POV of or the voice of the father.
And you read the production thing on that, right?
On
Viggo Mortensen was like dead against the monologues.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did not want to do them. And Helen Coates said, no, we have to. And Cormac McCarthy loved them.
Yeah, they're brilliant. You know,
he was on set when they were filming, by the way.
Yeah, he just passed away last year, right? Didn't that happen? Yeah. It's very recent. Mm-hmm. But to your point, then it's the simplicity of the rest of the dialogue. You know, the dialogue between him and the boy is, like you said, fairly sparse. One word at a time, that sort of thing.
And like you said, simplistic. Yeah.
And he deals with moments. That whole moment, again, there's so many vignette moments in this, but the whole moment of just finding the Coke and opening it up and letting the boy drink it, obviously the first Coke he's ever had. Right. Just his reaction to it. And you can tell he goes, it kind of burns and he likes it and it's great. It just,
and he burps.
Yeah. I think. It is just so priceless and good and so well told in just this little minor moments of stuff mm-hmm. that I don't think you could have with a lesser cast or lesser storytelling craft sort of thing. And the other two scenes I've got on my list that really stick out to me are the killing the Raiders scene. So that whole scene where the Raiders using the bathroom and they're hiding at the bottom of the hill, that whole sequence of we so don't know what's going to happen. You know, he's got the gun on him, but we know he only has two freaking bullets. And he even the Raider even says, you ain't never killed nobody before. And it just gets real. You're going, oh, my God, has he? We don't know enough about him to know if he has or not. I don't know what's going to happen. Da, da, da. And the fact that he has to kill him, literally almost killing his son at the same time, and then the running away, that whole sequence just, I was on edge. But you are in a lot of this movie. It goes from bleak to panic really quickly in this movie.
Over and over again. When they discover the people in that basement, I mean, he doesn't linger. They are running.
We got to run.
And the kid's the one that sees him out the window and says, we can't go that way.
Yeah.
You know, because they're coming.
And then you got all that tension of go upstairs and listen to him and blah, blah. I mean, all that.
And there's a lot of lying down and being quiet so people don't see you.
Yes. A lot of hiding. But like I said, we go from bleak, we're starving to death, we're walking along the road, we come out of it, we turn a corner over here, and suddenly we see all these skulls stacked up on sticks. And immediately it's like, get down and go away. We're going the other way.
He says something like, let's not go this way. Yeah. They just because he's trying to, I guess, keep the boy from realizing.
But you're instantly like, oh my God, what could happen? What could happen? Because he's left it so ambiguous. And I've got that in my watch notes that we'll get to, but, and then my last scene is of course the scene that really shocked me the first time, which is I'm going to teach my son how to commit suicide. And obviously they have done it before. And even down to putting the gun in your mouth kind of thing. I was going, oh my gosh, this to be in this situation where we're going to keep two bullets just in case. And then that's reinforced later on with the scene where they cut to the flashback and she throws down the two bullets and says, I should have saved one, you know, kind of thing. It's just, golly.
So they must have killed somebody.
Well, no, it's a flashback with Charlize and she throws down only two bullets and says, I should have saved some earlier kind of thing.
That's what I'm saying. Maybe they used them on somebody that tried to get their stuff.
Or probably hunting or something. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know what? You're right. It could have been hunting. A lot of the flashback stuff is not in the novel.
Oh, really? Okay. Didn't know
they
that.
They did that to beef up Charlize's character.
Which works for me. I mean, I thought it was just enough for her. I don't think we had needed more. But, gosh, it's just the performances in this are so amazing.
All of them.
All of them.
I mean, we'll get to cast when we get to it. But, I mean, everything about this movie really is the relationship between Viggo, the man, and what's his name? Something Smith McGee.
Yeah, who plays the boy? Cody.
The boy. Cody Smith. Yeah, it's their relationship. And I had the DVD, so I was watching. I watched a making of. I think I sent it to you, and I watched outtakes, like deleted scenes. And you can see in the making of Viggo and that boy playing and doing stuff off camera because he wanted to build that relationship with that kid.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see it.
Well, and you also see in interviews, not just in the making of, but online and everything else, you see Viggo with the book. And it's dog-eared and got little tabs in it everywhere. So obviously the source material was so important to him as as an actor in the piece, too. And you can tell. I mean, Viggo Mortensen is one of the best actors we have right now, I think.
When you watch this, I'm convinced because he's amazing. And he also lost like 30-something pounds to play the part, so he looks like a skeleton.
Yeah, the Hillcoat in one interview said he literally was starving himself for certain weeks of the production.
Did you see where he got thrown out of a store because someone thought he was a homeless person?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
damn, that's some method acting.
And he is method. He is very method. Yeah. He was method on Lord of the Rings. I mean, if you watch, you know, Return of the King, it's the same way. He is so expressive and emotive, and his scenes are so powerful.
And I love that he doesn't do a lot of mainstream movies. And even partners kind of with Cronenberg. He's done two films with Cronenberg.
Yeah, he's Cronenberg.
Which is very unusual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have two kind of questions for you, since you know the source material so well. One.
All right.
Does the father have hope? Does the father think they're going to reach something nice or something good, or when they get to the ocean it's going to be good or whatever?
You just made me think of something that might be there, but I can't really validate it. I think the father is slowly transitioning into the mother. I think that he is the one that is filled with hope in the beginning when she is not. And gradually, as he gets through this world, he realizes she's right. And I think, and then, of course, you know, when he gets sick and then eventually is shot by an arrow, it's quite obvious he's not going to live.
But he has said, like, 20 minutes before that in one of the voiceovers, he goes, "The one thing I did know is I am dying."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's before they're even in the church kind of thing. So I think that my take on it, having not read the book and having seen it the one time, I agree with you. I think, yes, he's slowly doing this character reversal to the hopelessness.
And that's just the movie. That's not the book.
Right. Okay. But I also think that he doesn't think they're going to reach anything. I think his whole goal is, we are on this trek so that I can teach you how to survive. I don't want you, my son, to die. And no matter what we encounter or what we see or whatever, I think you're destined to a bleak, hopeless future. But I want you to be able to have the strength to survive. And that's why he's actually, he does stuff that we, even as audience members, go, "Why are you, dude, why are you turning into the bad guy?" Like with the black guy, the thief that steals their stuff, and he steals it all back. Not only his stuff, but all of his stuff to him. Makes him take his clothes off. And all
the boy makes him take it back.
Yeah.
And leaves him a can of food.
Even though he's probably dead by then, but.
Or he's gone for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he ever found that.
right.
stuff. But yeah.
And so I think that my question, answering my question was, I don't think there is hope in him from halfway through this movie. I don't think he thinks going to the sea will be like where they're going to find a Mecca or a commune or something like that.
I think the sea is a good goal.
Yeah, it's a good goal to have.
Because it gets them somewhere that the boy has obviously never seen, and it gets them someplace where they may feel a little safer. And it also gets them off the road and particular, you know, maybe down a path of beach to warmer climate, which is
maybe
a strong motivator in this movie because they are freezing too.
Yeah. And, you know, but he even says when they get there, they cut to that one shot and it pans over and you see them standing on the edge of the dune. And he says, I'm sorry, it's not blue. You know, right. And you just go, golly, this is. But he says it was, Viggo says it was such a layering of, and I knew it wouldn't be. And what are we going to do now? And just in that one phrase. So, yeah. That was a question I had was, does he have
that scene where he swims out to the ship to get the flare gun?
Yeah.
Is a lot longer in the book. Like they have him on the ship looking around and stuff in the book. Cormac does.
Yeah.
It was very brief in the movie. They just basically show him go out to it and show him come back and that's it.
Yeah.
But, you've got me thinking of stuff I didn't even really think of, but I was talking about the role reversal of him and Charlize, but there's a role reversal with him and the boy too. The boy basically becomes him. The boy is him because he's filled with hope and he always has hope and he always has good in him and he remembers that we are the good guys. We carry the fire.
Carry the fire.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. 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 I think that's so true and so well. Again, I'm not comparing the source material because I can't, but for this movie.
I'm telling you, it's a very faithful adaptation.
It is so well done in the storytelling and in the ambiguity that he has. I mean, every situation in this is ambiguous and he gives us no answers and I don't mind. You know, there are other movies and we've even talked about because, you know, one of our favorite subgenres is post-apocalyptic. We both talk about it and we like it. We also like, short, small cast stories that focus on characters more than they focus on anything else. But we've even had other movies where we've talked about, you know, it bugs me that they didn't tell me how this happened, or it bugs me that I don't know why they're reacting the way they are based on we don't know their history or whatever. In this, we don't really care. He never says how it started or even what it is. Is it nuclear winter? Is it a meteor strike? Is it whatever? We just know that it's very, very cold. The skies are dark. There's ash everywhere, which implies fire of some kind, but we don't know why, right. sort of thing. And we really don't care. It really doesn't matter and affect us in this storytelling. And the same thing with all these situations. Every situation they end up with is ambiguous. That we see a dude walking ahead of us on the road. We don't know who he is. We don't know what he is. We don't know what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And the whole interaction that we have with him takes place. And then when it's over, it's over. And we don't say, oh, I wonder what happened to that guy. We don't worry about it. We're on to the next vignette. We're on to the next scene. We're on to the,
right.
oh, we're going to drink a Coke in a vending machine place or right. whatever. So it's just so – I was really impressed with this movie.
I'm shocked that you had never seen it. And I'm also shocked that it wasn't up for many awards, which really pisses me off.
Yeah, agreed. I think it definitely should be up for cinematography. I think acting should have – I mean, Viggo Mortensen should have been nominated for this. It's phenomenally well done. And the like you said, the ability – the amount of method he did – like not showering, not, starving himself literally, being kicked out of stores, keeping the same clothes on for 2 weeks at a time.
You know, and he didn't really keep track of it like most people would do.
No.
He said, I think I lost 30 pounds. He's not really sure how much he lost.
Yeah.
just basically ate less and less, you know, to make himself skinny. Kind of like Christian Bale did in that other movie.
Well, that's one of my key comparisons is him, Christian Bale, because Bale does the same thing. He'll gain 50 pounds or lose 100, you know. And McConaughey was like that to begin with. You know, I know for Buyer's Club, McConaughey lost, you know, like 40, 50 pounds, something for that film. But so there are those that do that. But I think Viggo does it psychically as well. I think he's almost like a Gary Oldman. He delves so much into the character and what the character is and how. And it shows on screen because he lost so much for Dallas Buyers Club and all of that. He lost like 40, 50 pounds.
There was some movie he did called The Machinist that I never saw.
Yeah.
And he got like so skinny you could count his ribs.
Yep. Well, and Viggo's like that in this. That scene where he takes his shirt off, you see that sunken stomach and all the ribs and everything. I was going, is he an Auschwitz patient? Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the boy looks that way too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that was – it says a lot about casting people who are willing to do that for this movie. And if you didn't have that, I think this movie would have faltered.
Yeah, it's dedication for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to lose weight too, but I'm not that strict.
Well, you need to get on the road with a gun with two bullets and just see what happens, buddy.
Yeah.
There you go.
And nothing to eat.
Nothing to eat. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess that's a good segue to casting because we're talking about Viggo.
Yeah.
We know him, of course, this year from Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
That reminds me, I actually shouldn't be segueing here, but we have another theme going I didn't even realize, but you've had like an apocalyptic theme going here, a little one, with On the Beach, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, and now this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're not horror apocalypses.
No.
They are reality type apocalypses, all three of them.
Yeah, they're like character studies with these situations.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. End of the world scenarios without zombies, basically. Anyway, back to Viggo. We know him from Lord of the Rings. I mentioned that he has a little history with David Cronenberg. He was in History of Violence, and he was also in a newer one. Do you remember what it is? I can't remember.
The one with the bodies.
Crimes of the Future.
Crimes of the Future, where they're body morphing or whatever.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. I've seen History of Violence, and it's great.
It's great.
It's him and Maria Bello, I believe, is in that as well.
Yeah.
I did not remember this at all because I have not seen this movie in decades. Mm-hmm. But do you know what his debut was?
No.
He was a young Amish farmer in Witness with Harrison Ford.
Excellent.
In 1989.
Good movie. Yeah.
He is a Renaissance man. You have talked about specifically how you admire him as far as his approach to acting, I think. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, but he's a Renaissance man. He is also a poet, a photographer, and a painter.
Mm-hmm.
He does a lot.
Horseback riding, lots of different weaponry he can do. Of course, swords that he's had experience with, but archery, handguns. He loves camping and fishing outdoors and doing all that kind of, He-Man outside stuff. So, yeah, he's very learned, I guess. Is that the good term for it? He reads a lot and knows a lot of history and uses that So like when it came down to Lord of the Rings, he read them all. He read all three novels and read up on Tolkien and everything else. For this one, obviously based on, like I said, he carried the book around with him.
This is a lot easier to read. It is a short book.
Well, I think as a method actor who just totally devotes himself to it, and you can tell in interviews with him, it's not about – let me say this. With Christian Bale, there are times when you see interviews with him offset and you feel like, I'm the martyr. I'm doing this to be recognized for doing this. Losing the weight, memorizing the foreign accent, doing whatever.
I'm Batman.
You never get that from Viggo Mortensen. You get the fact that this is a very sincere individual who's very soft-spoken, who's very quiet and very
empathetic. He would never play celebrity.
No.
He would probably treat anybody as anybody without playing on celebrity at all.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I get that from him.
I mean, I see him as like two notches above Harrison. You know, Harrison is so shy and so introverted and so quiet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see.
And so I can see Vigo a little bit more because he's, you know, he just is a little bit more outgoing, but still the same way. You could easily see him, no, I'm just going to build my cabin in the woods and stay up here and read books all day.
You know? Right.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mentioned his dedication and that he deliberately starved himself, and he got thrown out of a shop for being missing, for confused as a homeless man. But I just took note that that shop was in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, of course, is the home of George Romero and all those zombie films we were talking about.
Yep.
The boy was played, and I love how they don't have names, man and boy.
Yep.
Was played by Cody Smith McPhee. He won this part over hundreds of boys due to a strong audition, and I kept writing this in my notes, he looks like fucking Charlize Theron.
Yes,
he
does.
He looks just like her.
He does.
So he looks like her kid.
I agree.
So that was, that's one of the reasons he got cash.
And had he done anything before? Is this his debut? Because I didn't recognize him at all, nor have I seen him since, really.
Well, no, he's done stuff since.
Okay.
I don't think if he did anything before, I'm unaware.
Okay.
But since then, he was the boy in Let Me In, the remake of Let the Right One In.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And then he was also in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And he also plays Nightcrawler in the new, younger version of the X-Men.
I have to go back and look at that.
So, yeah, he's on the map. I mean, he's definitely doing other things. I don't know that he did anything before this, though.
Okay.
But this performance alone would have got him attention, I would think.
Should have. Or hopefully he did. Yeah.
He bonded with Vigo by eating crickets to help get in character.
There you go.
That's something I would not do.
Such Renaissance men.
Yuck. Gross. We mentioned that there are a lot of famous cameos in this movie. Mm-hmm. The biggest one is probably by Mr. Robert Duvall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Robert Duvall played Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird, Frank Burns in MASH. He was in The Godfather. He was in George Lucas's first movie, THX-1138.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a connection to him. I don't know if I've ever told you this story. I opened a Borders bookstore in Manassas, Virginia. And he had a horse farm a couple of exits further out from Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And he had a restaurant that he opened and brought a very accomplished chef to in this tiny little town that wasn't even a block. I can't remember the name of the town.
Okay.
But the name of the restaurant was The Train Stop. Because I actually dated a guy out there, and we went to that restaurant a couple of times hoping to see him, but he wasn't there. But one night, I was getting ready to close. It was about 8:45. Me and like one other employee in the Borders bookstore, and I'm up there straightening books on a bookshelf that's like new bestsellers, and they're on both sides. And I was down low on one side, and I stood up at the same time as Robert Duvall on the other side. And I did a double take. Because it was hard to recognize him, and he looked just like my dad.
Oh, yeah. I could see that.
He had on a baseball cap and a track suit, like a jockey suit. Yep. And he smiled at me, and I just smiled at him, and I went, I mean, it was like one of those things where I don't say anything. Yeah, it's like, we just recognize. And he said, are you getting ready to close? I said, you take your time, and I just walked away.
Yeah.
I mean, what else do you say?
That's freaking Robert Duvall, man.
Right. I didn't want to fan out on him, but it was just kind of startling because we would have been the closest shopping he would have because he was so far out in the country. And we were – Manassas at the time was the furthest civilization really outside of Washington, D.C., east toward West Virginia.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll stop gushing. The Neighborhood Playhouse School of the Theater in New York. Why am I reading this?
I have no idea. You were on Robert Duvall.
I know. Okay. Sorry. He studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse School of the Theater of New York. And I did not realize this, but he was friends with Dustin Hoffman and they shared an apartment.
Mm-hmm. I knew that.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Okay. That was in my notes as well. And a lot of the lines, or in particular, one line was not in the script. And these are things that he ad-libbed because he got tired. They had done so many takes and they kept it about him having a son himself.
Yeah.
At one time. That's not in the
And Vigo the book at all. Vigo kept the ad-lib and did the line about what was he like or something like that. And his response was, I'm not going to talk to you about it. You know, and that was so good. And so, you know, two great actors doing a scene that, the, you know, the director went, okay, we're keeping that. We're
gonna Yes. And Vigo was smart enough to make him keep talking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Share it and do it.
Yeah. That's, and he was, of course, the character of the old man that – you get to see the goodness of the boy in that scene as well, because he is clearly not in good health and stumbling down the road, but the boy wants to give him a can of food. It's a little more severe in the book. The father really doesn't want to have anything to do with him in the book.
Of course not.
It's not as, it's not as bad in the movie. And they, as a result, end up having dinner with him and then they part.
Yeah, it's probably basically the longest secondary character scene in the entire movie, even more so than Charlize. The dialogue they have, the amount of stuff they do and everything else is with Robert Duvall character, which is
right.
And again, ambiguity. Separate the next day and we never hear from him again or talk about him. That's just that was it. It was an experience and we're done with it. Moving on kind of thing. Yeah.
Other famous faces, Guy Pearce plays the veteran at the end that finds the boy on the beach after Vigo's character has died. And I love how Guy plays this character because you don't know if he's a good guy.
You don't know.
Right.
This is
he don't look like a good guy at all.
I mean, I guarantee Nicotero takes this scene and shows it to potential people on Walking Dead and say, this is the kind of scene I want you to play so that we don't know if you're going to eat them or not. You know,
right, kind if of you're going to be a bad guy or not.
Yes.
We know Guy Pearce from Memento, L.A. Confidential, and I know him personally from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, because that's the first time I ever saw him in anything.
Probably me too, but I remember.
Him and the guy, him and Mr. Smith from The Matrix. I can't think of his name right now. Anyway, they were both in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert with Terrence Stamp.
Oh, Agent Smith is...
Agent Smith. Yeah. Great, great cast in that movie. Hugo Weaving, Guy Pearce, and Terrence Stamp were in that movie. Yeah, that's a great cast.
Yeah.
Anyway, I always thought he was Australian. I did not realize he's English.
Yep.
I think he moved to Australia at a young age. And of course, Priscilla is an Australian movie. He played the man at the end. The woman the motherly woman is how she's billed, is also a familiar face. That's Molly Parker. She has been in tons of stuff, but I know her mainly from that series Deadwood on HBO. Mm-hmm. She was one of the leads in that show. And she does not look threatening at all. I think she looks legit motherly. They wanted her.
I think that was a definite. And that's also why we don't see the other boy and the dog until he's made his decision, until he's coming back. And we realize it's a family kind of thing. That's a great sequence. And just the way he shoots it, you know, there's at the beginning, it's very from the boy's POV. You're looking up at the veteran, the guy. And so that's very intimidating. And he's looking down and you don't know. And he even pulls the gun on him and you still don't know. And he then kneels down and suddenly we're on the same level. And that helps. I mean, it's just really good decisions.
And Guy also, it's his dialogue, but all of a sudden he starts sounding a little bit like Vigo. He's like, you're going to have to make a decision here.
Yeah.
You know, whether you stay or come with us.
Yep.
and it's just great. It's really good.
The only thing I did,
I have that scene right here. There it is.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't buy at all was them saying they've been following them for weeks, and I was thinking, why? Why? A, why would you follow them for weeks? And B, if you were following them, why wouldn't you ever approach them ever? Because of the man? You were afraid of the man? You
did. They were afraid of the man. The reason they would follow him, and I loved how, you know, and it's more prominent in the book, but he senses that someone's following him. Because I think he accuses the guy that steals their stuff as the guy that was following. He said, you've been following us.
Yeah, well, and when he shoots the guy with the flare gun, he says, why were you following us? And she goes, we weren't following you.
And that, that's in the book. He feels like someone's following him. And in reality, someone is following him. It's this family. I think they're following him because they're trying to figure out if he's good or not. Or maybe they realize that he's gonna die, and she clearly wants the kid because she's
for breeding
and
purposes,
she has
probably
two of her own. Yeah, to start repopulating.
Yeah,
the world.
That's what it is.
But anyway, great cast. Another famous face. There's more. I mean, there's tons. Mm-hmm. Michael Kenneth Williams plays the thief that takes their stuff when Viggo's out of the boat. Michael Kenneth Williams died recently. He had a drug problem. Oh, I hate that.
Dang.
I know him. Well, he was known for The Wire and 12 Years a Slave. I know him personally from Hap and Leonard. He played Leonard in the Joe Lansdale series, Hap and Leonard.
Okay.
And he is just a marvelous actor. He's got a scar on his face that's real.
Mm-hmm.
From like a knife fight when he was young. Anyway, can't say it. He does so much with so little dialogue in that scene where Viggo is making him take his clothes
off. Oh, my gosh. I mean, him crying and the way you don't have to do this, man.
And snot coming out of his nose.
You don't have to do this to me, man. And you're just like, right. Oh, my gosh.
He's like, well, you're going to do it to us. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really good. It was really good.
Yeah. Another one. Another famous face is the guy you mentioned that's the gang member at the beginning.
Oh, wow.
And he is Garrett Dillahunt. He was also in Deadwood with Molly Parker. He was in No Country for Old Men, which is another Cormac McCarthy property.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Raising Hope, which was a great comedy that didn't last very long on television. And then I knew him from Fear the Walking Dead. Fear the Walking Dead is a show I have a love-hate relationship with. I like the way it started. It kind of got bad. Then it got good again because Garrett Dillahunt came on and was a good guy. He was like a cowboy.
Right.
And then the next season, they killed him off. And I just said, fuck it. I'm not watching this anymore. So
I remember I like you him. Talking about that.
Yes. Well, and he is – he. I remember him – early on as playing bad guys, because he was also in the remake of Last House on the Left as a bad guy.
Okay.
And he's in this as a bad guy. But then he started doing good guys on like Raising Hope and Return of the, Fear of the Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. All right. So Garrett Dillahunt's in it. And then lastly, Charlize Theron plays the mother. We mentioned her. Mm-hmm. She's Furiosa in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yep.
She won an Academy Award in Monster. She is in Atomic Blonde, which has a sequel coming very soon.
Aeon Flux.
And and she is the executive producer of Mindhunter. Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that.
I did not know that.
Yep.
Anyway, she plays the mother, and she is great, and I understand why they beefed her part up.
Yeah, I loved the when the one behind the scenes you sent me that I watched talking about her and the director saying, I don't know if you'll be able to do the primal scream of birth the way I want it, so we'll just dub that. And she went, no, let me try. And she blew him away.
And she ruined her vocal cord.
Yeah.
She said she's never recovered from
it. Yeah, she says she actually has a scarred vocal cord because of it. But – which were, I mean, it's fine. To take the character in those limited scenes, some of them with maybe one sentence of dialogue in the entire scene, and you're going from this loving wife, pregnancy, mother to suicidal. all in just this arc of your character.
And a lot of it is told with set decoration.
And with
like early on, it doesn't look disheveled because he's just putting stuff in the bathtub.
Yep.
But then you start seeing like things stacked in front of windows and like dirty shit, dishes everywhere and stuff.
No more electricity. They're using candles now. And then
they're using candles. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So it was really... The way he did the production design of this and the way he told this story was so great. I mean, I've got in my notes, you know, we did do two post-apocalyptic prior to this. But both
not long ago.
But both of them are very centric to society and society collapsing. There is no reference in this to society. Not even a commune. Not even, you know, the village or the community like in Walking Dead. There's no... The only societies we see are a cannibal family in a house or a cannibal group in a house.
It's a group. I don't think it's a family.
Right.
Yeah.
And another group of marauders.
On the road. Yeah.
And that's it. There is no societal communes, no trappings of society, no, oh, what happened to society? Oh, guilt about what happened and, oh, we're terrible and we brought this on ourselves. There's none of those trappings that happen a lot in post-apocalyptic stories. And they're not needed.
No, we neglected to mention the scene where they see the woman running with her kid from some of them and he refuses to help.
Well, of course, there's like nine of them.
Right.
So,
but the boy's really like upset about it, and he's trying to get the boy away from there before they become targets.
And all you hear is her screaming, you know, and so you know that's the brutality. That's another thing. There's, I don't know if it's in his other works, because I have seen No Country for Old Men, but I've never read the book. And I don't know if Cormac.
He's brutal.
I don't know if he has a. I don't know if he has a really optimistic view of humans.
Well, I mean, he does both. Like, he has a trilogy that All the Pretty Horses is in, and that is not bleak or as violent as, like, Blood Meridian or No Country for Old Men or Child of God or The Road. All four of those novels are brutal.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't. It doesn't seem that he has a great deal of faith in humanity.
But you need to read him because he's one of the best writers America's ever produced.
Well,
he really is.
He definitely. Just hearing that opening narration from Vigo, you suddenly go, "This is like Hemingway. This is like Faulkner. This is such great verbiage."
Well, Hemingway was a minimalist too.
Yeah,
and so is McCarthy.
Yeah, that makes sense.
For sure,
that makes sense. Yeah. That would be definitely keys that I would have for them.
Yeah, you're hitting a key to me, which is literary nerdness. But anyway, I'll move on. As far as awards, this movie, I was shocked, did not really get nominated for any. The BAFTAs nominated it for cinematography. That's over in England. Mm-hmm. And not even the Oscars gave it a nomination. It got the Critics' Choice for Young Actor, Actor, and Makeup. It didn't get them. It was nominated for them. So it didn't win those.
Of course.
And then the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror, the Saturn Awards, nominated it for Best Actor and Performance by a Younger Actor. None of these did it win, which just absolutely baffles me.
Yeah. Agreed. I mean, cinematography alone, I thought it's very interesting. You know, I think we talked about it when we did Fury Road. He used a lot of CGI only for treatments. So, like, color saturation and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, like, when they were in the storm, it had all the blues. And then when they were in the desert, it had a lot of the oranges. And it was just in what he did in the background to color the scenes. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to know the process in this one because, I mean, you've got two great examples behind you. The majority of this movie is gray. It's not black and white. There's some ruddiness to the faces or the hands or certain things. You know, the butt of the gun is wooden. You know, so you're seeing color, but it's very gray saturated unless it's a flashback, which there are two flashbacks that are in intense color. The one in the church?
It's like a golden warm.
Well, most of them, if it's a happy moment or a flashback, it's gold or has a goldish hue to it, almost like a candlelight tint to it. But there's like one in the church when, you know, she's wearing the blue dress and he's got the red tie on and it's just like, oh my God, that's the most color I've seen in the past hour. But just that usage of that, and even down to like the last scene, the Guy Pearce scene, you can start to see greens and gray and navies and a little bit in that color, the way he does it. So it's very interesting, that choice. And why that wasn't nominated for cinematography, I have no freaking idea.
Yeah, I agree. And it also is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. And I totally disagree with that as well. Yeah. This movie should be on there.
It should be in the, it should probably be in the top 50, in my opinion. And I haven't, you know, this is the first time I've ever seen it.
So, yeah. And I neglected to mention that there were tons more nominations on the smaller festival circuit, but it didn't win any.
No.
It won very few things. This movie just kind of disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I've never watched it, really. I mean, I've heard about it. I've heard, ooh, dark, depressing, bleak. I don't know if I want that, blah, 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 you know. And then I've heard, you know, in doing research, you know, there were reviews I was watching where people were going, you know, the ending's a cop-out. I don't like the ending. That was ridiculous.
That's bullshit.
And I was going, hell, they broadcast that for like 2 hours before. and it
oh,
worked.
You mean that he dies?
Well, no, that the family rescues the boy.
Okay. People, well, see, I don't think
I think it's great.
Predictable.
No, I don't think it's predictable. I think it it works with the storytelling that he's doing. You know, like I said, I think the entire purpose of this is not to take my son to Valhalla somewhere or some Mecca or some commune or some, you know, it's to teach him to survive because I'm not going to be here forever. And he's got to learn.
And it's ambiguous too because they may just go down the beach and get eaten tomorrow.
Of course. And but I think that's why the father, the man, I think that's why his paranoia increases with every encounter. And he gets so bad by the end of it, he literally fires into a window just because he heard something or he got shot or whatever, you know, sort of thing.
He kills that dude. With a flare gun.
His humanity is going away, whereas the boy is trying to.
Well, I mean, that arrow sealed his fate. He was already going down, and that arrow, you know, he's not going to heal from that.
Oh, I kept thinking this was going to be a Walking Dead sort of thing or whatever, and his cough was going to give him away somehow. Because, you know, the cough increases as the movie goes on.
Right.
And I kept thinking they're going to be one of those silent moments where they're hiding somewhere and he's going and they're going to get busted. And it was just going, you know, it's terrifying.
Before we move on to keys and trivia, I neglected to mention – what do you know about John Hillenkoetter?
Nothing.
The director of this movie.
Nothing. I've not looked at him at all.
I didn't either.
Uh-huh.
And I looked him up and was not really familiar with his films. But guess what he did do that I have been telling you was great here recently?
What?
He created and directed all six episodes of George and Tammy. Country music biopic.
Oh, okay.
Of George Jones and Tammy Wynette.
Yeah.
Yes. And I was like, I was blown away by how good that was with Jessica Chastain. And I can't think of the other guy's name that played George. But anyway, John Hillcoat did that.
Well,
so
I just glanced.
He's already done something I like.
I just glanced at his IMDb and he seems to like those pseudo biopics. He's got Johnny Cash, She Used to Love Me a Lot as a video.
He's a country music fan.
He's got Bob Dylan, Visions of Joanna. He directed the video.
That's an old song. I wonder why they made a video of it.
Bob Dylan, Odds and Ends. He did the video. So he's done a lot with music, which is interesting.
And biops, yeah.
Which is interesting because the music to this movie – we also didn't touch on, but as far as trivia goes, really, really good and really, really minimalist.
It's very little. I was going to say, I don't even remember it.
Well, piano. It's all piano because remember, that's what Charlize,
she played.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh.
Did you have any trivia you want to go through?
None that sticks out other than my big trivia is it was filmed, of course, in Pittsburgh, majority of it. And then they also shot in Oregon at the site of Mount St. Helens because of the devastation that they wanted.
Right.
And in Louisiana at sites that were ravaged by Katrina.
Right.
Because I kept looking at it going, is that a CGI? You know, and some of it was, of course, you know, you got huge boats up on top of highway overpasses. I was going, okay, so that's just a.
But that one shot with the two ships that are in like on land,
mm-hmm.
that is, I think, a Hurricane Katrina shot. I think they just, you know, masked it with other debris and stuff.
Yeah. They just put it in with, you know, them overall doing it. Yeah. So,
yeah, or like maybe they were in a, I don't know, in water, but the water was gone or something. It looked like they were on land.
But yeah, that's really the only trivia I have.
I've got a couple.
Yeah.
One is there's a scene in the book that he filmed but cut it mm-hmm. because he thought it was too much.
Okay.
And it's a baby on a spit. Yeah. Well, and that I remember it in the book. I mean, they see it. It's like,
those skulls.
Left behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's still, I can't remember if it's still cooking or not, but it's what's left of it, I guess. And then this I thought you would find interesting. The scene outside the tunnel was filmed in the Rays Hill Tunnel in Bedford County, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It's a 13-mile stretch that is called the Abandoned Pennsylvania Turnpike. Have you ever heard of this?
Uh-uh.
This sounds creepy as shit. The tunnel was originally built in the 1880s to serve as a railroad tunnel, but was never used. In the 1930s, the tunnel was repurposed to become part of a new turnpike system.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1960s, the stretch of turnpike was rerouted because of traffic congestion, and this original part, which includes two tunnels, is abandoned.
Why isn't there a movie about that? Let's do a found footage about that. Come on.
I mean, if we live there, we would be filming.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a great place to film.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah. It's awesome. Anyway, I wonder if they, they filmed all of Walking Dead in Georgia, so I guess they wouldn't have gone up there to do a location, but it'd been cool if they had. That's all I have. I've just got keys.
Oh, I have. Oh, wait. One trivia that is this movie has 3 Academy Award winners in it.
Oh, yeah.
So Viggo, Charlize, and Robert Duvall. All 3.
What did Viggo win for?
Good question. I can't tell you. But I'm pretty sure it was. Wasn't it Cronenberg's?
It, you know what? I think he was nominated for Cronenberg's. I don't remember.
If it wasn't History of Violence, it might be Eastern Promises, which was the other.
I think it was History of Violence. I think you're right because it was. I remember being shocked that Cronenberg got an Academy Award because you just don't associate him with that.
So, keys. I have a couple that are taken directly from what my genre topic was, which is one is Mandalorian and Creator, because they're both kind of the same kind of thing, but that whole man protecting the child through the ravages of the world sort of undercurrent, which mm-hmm. is what this is. And then the most topical one, I think, right now is Last of Us, which was the series based on the game, very highly acclaimed last year. It may even win some Emmys, that sort of thing. And it is the same story, a man and a child protecting a child through an adventure, through a wasteland.
The zombie apocalypse or whatever.
It's a zombie viral apocalypse, yeah.
Right. But, what was the first one you said before that?
Mandalorian.
Oh, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right.
It's the same thing.
We've been touching on Mandalorian a lot today.
Got to protect the baby. You know, sort of thing. So,
My first key is obviously going to be the book.
Yes, should be.
And Cormac McCarthy's writing in general, like I said, is brutal at times and beautiful at others. This book won a Pulitzer Prize, folks. If you haven't read it, go get it.
Wow.
I'm okay. telling you. Well, I mean, it's not for the weak of heart. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it is well worth reading. And like I said, this movie is a very faithful adaptation of it. I also had A Boy and His Dog.
Yep. I've got A Boy and His Dog.
Yep. Because it's essentially a man and his kid, but it's a lot better than that movie.
Yeah. Well, that movie tends to be, but I also have a pseudo key link out of that, which is Harlan Ellison. And doesn't he have either a novella or a short story that has man refers to man and boy, or man and dog, man and thing? It's not A Boy and His Dog.
Man and it's Boy and Dog, isn't it? No,
it's a. There's another one that I'm pretty sure, and I meant to look it up, but there's a short story. Out, if you're out there listening or watching, let me know. But it's either a short story or a novella, and he refers to the. There's no names in it. It's all pronouns or descriptive. It's either boy, man, you know, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
And then the other two I mentioned already, which you said the minimalist writers of the 20th century, Faulkner and Hemingway. Both of them, I think, are high key influences on this. I don't know if they influenced Cormac or not, but I know that
– I would say that Cormac is definitely influenced by both of them.
Yeah.
Hemingway for the prose – what's the word I'm looking for? Besides minimalism, but where you just capture it in very few words. And Faulkner for the Southern stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I have, of course, The Walking Dead, because it is The Walking Dead without zombies.
Yep.
But as far as modern – or not modern, but apocalyptic movies, you know, we did On the Beach and The Day the Earth Caught Fire, but we also talked about movies like The Day After and Threads.
Yep.
Where it looks, like you said, a nuclear winter, basically, because they're freezing.
Mm-hmm.
We do not know that that's the case, though. They never say why this happened. We don't know if it's bombs. We don't know if it's a meteor. We don't know what.
Right. Could be global warming that caused massive fires that then firestormed all around the world or whatever.
Right. And that leads to my next key, which is George Romero. And that is that he never explains anything either.
Correct.
You know, there's zombies getting up and killing people, yet we never know why.
Yep. Well, I think you also need to include Road Warrior. Just because of that post-survival and following that solo figure as he hits all these little situations.
It's also the fact that, you know, Mad Max and Road Warrior are basically centered on roads, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the action takes place on roads or in vehicles.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. The road. I've got... a couple of others that are in the genre of just – these came listed. If you Google and search 10 most depressing movies of all time, this is always up there. And again, I disagree with that because I do think the very ending is kind of uplifting. Although
I agree completely.
Although it
has – the whole time I was watching it. Yeah.
Yeah. Although it has a bleak outlook throughout and also not a great, you know, supporter of humanity – sort of thing, as far as how we will devolve into savages again. But the other movies that came up on that list, which are similar keys to this, The Mist, you know, we talked about that when we covered it.
That does not have a happy ending.
No. It has a very depressing ending, but it also talks about the, you know, humanity devolves, but it's a father-son story. So it has some keys in there for that. The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. Extraordinarily depressing movie.
Is it a post-apocalypse?
No. It's just in that.
I don't know.
It's just in that list of depressing movies.
Depressing. Okay, so it's not necessarily a key. All right.
It's about a boy who is part of a German family that lives right next door to a concentration camp, and he befriends. He befriends a boy, a young Jewish boy, and he calls him the Boy in the Striped Pajamas. And it's bleak.
Yeah.
It's freaking bleak. And then the other one, just as bleak, but in a weird sort of way that always comes up on these lists, is Requiem for a Dream. So, you know, there's those that Again, I tend to disagree with all these people touting how depressing this movie is.
Totally. And it's so funny that you're the one hammering this home, because the whole time I was watching this movie and reading the book, I was thinking, making mental notes. This is not a sad movie. This is a great ending. This has a happy ending. Why do people think this is – I mean, it's obviously too much for some people to handle because they picture themselves in the same situation. But it is it ends happy. I wanted to beat that over the head, and you're doing it for me. So that's great.
Sorry.
No, I love it. I love it. I had forgotten that I was going to say that, and it does. People need to see this movie.
I also watched another YouTube that had it was called The Symbols in the Road and Cormac McCarthy. And what they said, and I just took the notes on it, they said, there's ash. You see ash a lot. You see it, and at first you think it's almost snow, and because at the beginning it really is, and they're in a snowy area. But as they get farther south, and they're, especially when they see civilization more, it's ash everywhere. And they said the ash in the story represents hopelessness, and it's everywhere. But the boy represents hope, and most of his dialogue is hopeful or questioning hope. So he's always like, are we the good guys? Are we ever going to find – what are we going to find at the beach?
Are we ever going to eat people?
Are we ever – we're not going to be that way, are we?
We wouldn't eat a dog. Correct. Would we? Yeah.
And it says that most of the others, in any other capacity you use them – and I think Robert Duvall, I disagree with this with the Duvall character, but everybody else, yes, except for the very end – represents anarchy and immorality. And they and
I wouldn't say that the Michael Williamson character does either. He just was stealing because he didn't kill that boy. He could have killed the boy. All he did was take the stuff.
True. Because they show him approaching with the knife, that great big huge like machete knife.
It's like a red herring, but he just takes the stuff and lets the boy stay asleep.
Oh, agreed. I think that's a good point. That's a valid point.
Yeah. But before we close, I had one more key, and you mentioned, this is not a great key, but we covered this movie last season, The Omega Man. The thing I remember most about that movie as a kid was him always finding bodies that were dead or just, skeletons or whatever, and there is a lot of that in this. They're going into houses or going into a barn and there's people hanging from a rafter or what have you. There's just dead bodies, skeletons with ash on them, whatever.
I love
and
the one scene where
the Omega Man.
I love the one scene where in the bedroom and he pulls the blanket back and there's a skeleton there and he shakes it off and smells it and then wraps the boy in it.
Right.
No dialogue at all.
Right. That scene right there reminds me of The Omega Man, and it reminds me of The Stand.
Yeah.
The Stephen King story.
Two very true ones. As a matter of fact, I've got – one of my keys is Soylent Green because, people. So
And they eat. But that's more manufactured. Yeah. That's like a corporate thing.
I just have it because, cannibalism is people. So,
cannibalism.
And my last two, we said Christian Bale and Gary Oldman. I said those just as far as inspirational keys for actors method. Who sacrifice method sort of thing.
Right.
But I have one that's hopefully why did I say hopefully? Which is possibly a future key coming out this year, which is that new movie called Civil War. Which has it's supposedly a future set of America as we fall into civil war. And
another one.
this one looks very brutal and very interesting. The trailer looks great for it. And they have the scene where the guy is with his family. Obviously, you see a female and a kid. And in front of him are like three or four guys all with guns. And he is literally on his knees pleading, a la very Walking Dead, very The Road kind of thing, saying, please, 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 no, we're all Americans. And the other guy with the gun just kind of laughs and spits and goes, what kind of American? And then it cuts. And you go, oh, my God. Oh
where
my
is
God.
This so, and when is it coming?
It's a new movie coming out called Civil War. And I can't remember the director right now, but they're really good. I'm going to look it up real quick and see if I can find it. what was his name? But it's coming out this year.
Okay.
Kirsten Dunst is the lead in it.
I love her.
Yeah. And the director is Alex Garland.
I mean, come on. That's sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
That's the guy from Ex Machina. And
I think, wasn't he 28 Days Later, too?
Yep.
Yeah.
So, that looks really disturbingly good.
Okay, yeah, I'm curious.
The poster has like the Liberty torch, just a close up of the torch, and there's gunmen and snipers mounted all around it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Yay! Uplifting. <Well.
laughs> I think that's going to do it for today's episode.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to say that we like this movie.
We do.
Tim loves this movie and actually lifted it up to maybe his top 20 of all time. David had never seen the movie, but I have a feeling he'll be watching it again.
Yep.
And we'd like to thank you for joining us today. We are winding down our season.
We are.
Where are we? We only have 6 more episodes left this season.
Wow. Okay.
But next week, we, of course, will be in my territory of a little bit of horror land. And until next time. Oh, you know, while we got you here, we got to say the rigmarole of, you know, please subscribe, like, leave us a review if you're on YouTube. Please go down and comment. Just, you know, tell us that, yeah, I like this movie, too. Or I thought it was terribly depressing. Whatever.
Right. You can disagree with us.
Yeah, absolutely. We got some other short shows on YouTube if you want smaller bites. And we also have, if you want larger bites, some stuff over on Patreon. We'd appreciate you helping to support our delirium. And for as little as a cup of coffee a day, maybe 2 if you're feeling generous, we have some extra shows over there as well as bonus content that is free. There's just a whole bunch over there, so just go check it out.
Please.
And until next time, I will be seeing you, David.
See you then.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.